to PCMC where the kids on the street are calling pop culture man children. This is the only podcast that reaches the beaches and rules the pools. I'm here with my good friend yours, Mr. Emilio Sparks.
This is the most I've been on in years.
Yeah, like, you've been, what was you when you just back in October?
Yeah, well, I have to tell
Happy
you.
Happy New Year. Larry David would say it's too late, but
I'm just seeing you.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's Happy New Year. Yeah, Happy it's New fine. Year. Yeah, everybody else, fuck off. Like, yeah. I've already told you it.
Yeah.
I didn't even text anybody for New Year's, actually.
No, yeah, I'm like, you know, I'm good. The more, and we're like, we might even be in February at this point, but I don't give a shit when this episode comes out. Here's the thing. We were just talking about this off air. Who gives a shit? Like, I stayed up to midnight with Jen and Peach, but I don't know why. I don't care. You said you were in bed, right?
Dude, I was in bed by 10:45. Ugh.
Before I was with Jen, I was doing that. She still cares, I guess, but I could give a shit. I didn't, you know, it used to be the biggest deal in the world. Like, oh my God, a new year. It seemed to mean so much. But the more you live, the more you're like, first of all, you want to turn it around? You got every day to turn it around, baby. You don't got to wait to January 1 to turn it all around.
Well, see, we know that because we're lived men. We've had experiences in life, so we totally understand these things. But for most, they want to start from scratch and have... They want chapter one. They want the blank slate that calendar year because there's so much of an emphasis on starting over. But you and I both know you want a healthy habit. You want to get into your resolutions. Just do it.
Just like, fucking do it.
You can start February 16th. You could start January 1st. Yeah. You could start July 6th.
Yeah, and don't say, I'm going to change everything. You know what I mean? Like, you make some small fucking
changes.
Strides towards
That's it. Things. Life is fucking messy. Figure out how you want to clean it up and how you want to recalibrate your nervous system. That's the most important thing for me.
Yeah.
And so I made the conscious decision to go to bed early because, one, I just didn't feel good. I was like, I'm done. And all I did was hang out with my parents and treat them to dinner. So I was like, fuck this. I'm going to bed. I excused myself from the birthday whatevers because it is my mother's birthday. So she did have some, you know, family over, and I just excused myself. I was like, I'm terribly under the weather.
See, if I were your mother, though, I would treat it. Because that's your birthday and New Year's. I would treat that as important. I'd be like, this is really a rollover, a tick-tick of the clock.
Well, it always has been. Right. So, you know, it's her birthday. Other than that, it's just another day. To quote the wise Sylvester Stallone, when he's skating with Adrian and she's like, but it's Thanksgiving. He goes, yeah, to you. To me, it's just Thursday.
And for those of you playing at home, click the Rocky quote on your PCMC bingo card.
That I always do.
Yeah, that's actually the free piece in the middle.
Yeah, you know, we've never really got into any of the Stallone films.
Is that can't be true?
I don't think we've ever analyzed them.
No, there's never been a full episode on like.
I mean, we've talked about them. I think the first 100 episodes I was on.
Oh, it comes up a lot. But no, we've never. But that's like we've never had an episode on like the movie Star Wars from 1977. Hasn't happened.
Right.
Some things are just like foundational in a sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
But by the way, I'm not averse to it. I would love to do a fucking
Rocky. Because folks, to get on
an 8-week series.
I'm down to do an 8-week series.
No, more. We'll go all the way to fucking Creed 3, which I've not seen, by the way.
It's really good.
Is it really?
Yeah. So should I tell you how I rank the Creeds?
Yes, there's three.
There's three.
How would you rank the Creeds?
I'm doing Creed 1, Creed 3, Creed 2.
Creed 2 is a little bit too...
Self-serving. Didn't need it.
It's a little self-serving for Sly.
Yeah. Very self-serving
for... And then
for
in 3, he's not involved at all, right?
He's not involved at all.
Which, is he dead? Is he just like, he's over there now?
No, they like kind of like played it off like Rocky was with Robert. He's been spending time with Robert. Robert was in Portland, Oregon. He lives.
So
in Oregon.
Is he trained himself? Is there a new trainer for the Creed?
Well, he has Duke Jr.
Okay.
Yeah.
Duke Jr.
Yeah. As his
and
trainer.
Then Michael B. Jordan directed the third one, right?
Yeah, he did. It's really
good.
So
that's good. It's all him.
Yeah, it's his baby. Which rightfully so, it was incredible.
That might be Patrick H. Willems did a a long, like, two-part series on Lego sequels. And I don't know if he... I don't remember. He does talk about Creed. And I don't remember if he said it's one of the only successful ones. I'm trying to remember if I just, or if I just thought that right now. But in a way, if the real idea is to restart it with new people and you give a shit about new people, Creed might be the only successful one when you think about it, right? Because like, you look at the new Star Wars movies, people still like, yeah, but where's Luke or whatever? Like, by Creed 3, you're saying it's one of the best ones and...
Because you don't need Stallone. Stallone could be like his Yoda.
Yeah.
But you don't need the Yoda because he has his wife.
There was a perfect amount of him in Creed 1.
It was the right amount.
Right.
You know? And I think what happened was it rectified all the nonsense in 5. And then by Rocky 6... It was like, all right, they figured out and they fleshed out what the character should be in the modern age.
Yeah.
And then by the time you get to Creed 1, you have this broken man who is completely lonely and isolated from the only family that he has, which is his son Robert.
Right.
Because they had a strained relationship in Rocky 6. Yeah.
Which I think is really good.
And then they carried that over.
Yeah.
But then here you have this guilt over Apollo, and now he has his son.
Yeah.
And now how he wants to, he has to not, it's like he makes right.
What's the son is?
Adonis.
No. But Stallone's son is, what's his name?
From Robert.
This Is Us. No, but what's his name?
Milo.
He's Jess.
Milo.
Yeah.
Milo Vigimagagagagaga.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jess. The best.
He's Jack.
The best
Jack.
Of Rory's girlfriend, boyfriends, excuse me.
You know what? He really was, even though he was an isolated piece of shit.
Well, Dean, Jen always gets mad at me, but I always felt Dean had great sexual tension with Lorelai. And Jen would be like, that's not what this show is. That's not what's happening. I'd be like, look at the way that they talk.
Oh, they wanted to sleep with each other.
Yeah.
He wanted to canoodle her. I know she had that strapping man known as Luke.
Yeah.
Which I think Dean, his head would go through the fucking coffee dispenser if Luke ever found out that he
Dean
tried to make a move.
Was a little bit of a, I don't know. He was a little too soft. But Logan was a sociopath.
Yeah, absolutely. I hate Logan. I don't like him.
I hate him, and I hate that.
I always hated he called her Ace too.
Yeah, what? Yeah.
Like, go fuck you. What are you, prick?
All right, none of this is what we're here to talk about. What we're here to talk about today is...
We're starting a new podcast called Stars Hollow.
There are so many...
Jen, you want to do it with me? We'll do it together, Jen? Would.
There are so many Gilmore Girls podcasts out there. So many.
I think if we were to do the spinoff, like this would be one of the Norman Lear spinoffs.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I think we would do it incredible. And then I could probably maybe make some connections and get some of these people on.
We can get all the members of Happy Alien.
I would love to.
Mrs. Kim?
Mrs.
If
Kim.
If we could land Mrs. Kim, you could probably honestly, and I'm not trying to be mean here, you could get Luke real easy.
Oh, easy.
Luke will do anything.
Oh, I mean, come on. He's in Sullivan's Crossing right now.
What the fuck is that?
Oh, buddy.
Is that the movie with the leprechaun?
No, it's a...
The Francis Ford Coppola directed?
No, it's like a...
Gotta be a doctor show.
No, yeah, it is. And it's a joint venture between, I guess, whatever Canada Broadcasting Network and the CW. And it stars Chad Michael Murray.
Sure.
And then some
another
like,
person from Gilmore Girls.
Chad Michael? That's right.
He was like the kind of like bad boy.
Well, they all were bad boys.
Chilton. Yeah.
They
he
all...
was like a proto... What's his name? Logan.
It's amazing how many bad boys Stars Hollow actually churned out.
Yeah. For like the whitest, most like upper crest.
No, but
place.
Sullivan's Crossing is definitely it has to deal with the medical world, yes.
Of course.
But it's a girl who, it's a woman.
Yeah.
Who, do you want me to give away the plot?
No. I want to forget this.
I'm all in.
Today's episode. I know. I can tell you. Today's episode is about Uncle Buck.
UB.
From 1989. Written and directed by John Hughes only. And you know this motherfucker? He would write a script in like a week. There's something very bespoke about his movies.
It's a nice way to put it.
he'll write a script in 2 weeks. He'll direct, like even if they're like bigger movies with that have a little bit more money, there's some sense that you could feel like he's entirely in charge of it.
Of course he is.
But how do I put it? Obviously the director is always the biggest artistic voice, but like
not in a John Hughes film.
He's well, it is, but he's like the only voice almost. It's like he writes it and then he like, for lack of a more eloquent term, like shits it out, and it's like it just was in his head and now it's out. And
but isn't that the magic though with the turnaround time? So he conceptualizes it right down to even how he wants the sets to look.
Yeah.
And that is, I think it's indicative in the writing, because right. what you see, what you get from the page to the screen, I don't think there's a shift in any type of change.
No, I think he knows exactly what he wants. And then gets it. Like, I know, like, there's, like, little bits of improv. Like, if he knows he's hiring, like, John Candy or something. But, like, for the most part, it's all there. Like, there's, like, I think that there's no, like, fat on the bone there. But let's just talk about our relationship with it. I absolutely love Uncle Buck. This is, I haven't seen every single John Hughes movie. I've seen all the big ones. And without a doubt, this is my favorite John Hughes
movie. I want to see how many John Hughes films there are that I haven't seen, because I genuinely believe I think we've seen them all.
You've seen all the important ones, I'm sure. You've seen all the important ones. There's another movie that he made a few years later in 1991 called Dutch with Ed O'Neill. Which I feel like could have been an Uncle Buck sequel. It's sort of a combination of two of his other movies. If you take Uncle Buck and marry it with Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, that's where you get Dutch. And I Dutch is really slept on. I really like Dutch. It's a great Thanksgiving movie.
It is. I don't know if it could be an Uncle Buck sequel.
Well, all right. It's Shanice's son in boarding school. He's got to go pick him up.
But right, but would it work if John Candy starred in Dutch instead of Ed O'Neill?
Ed O'Neill has a darker, he's got a more of an edge.
He does.
Whereas I think Candy, Candy's just a big sweet teddy bear. So he would soften it, I think. You know, I don't see John Candy like shooting the kid in the ass with like the BB gun, like Dutch does. But then again, in this movie, he does like tie a teenager up and put him in the trunk of a car and then, you know, hit golf balls at him.
So I looked up his filmography and there are a lot that I haven't seen. And I don't know if I have a pull to want to watch these films.
Not only that, sir, at some point, the crown of auteurship was too much for him. And he started writing scripts under fake names just so he wasn't involved. And the word on the street is all of the Beethoven movies, like Beethoven 1 through 17, VHS only, were all written by John Hughes.
What did he need? Like, just needed the cash?
I guess he hung it up and became like reclusive, or not reclusive. He just didn't talk to the press way early in his life. Like, he like stopped at some point.
I want to know the length of time and what caused this. So in 2002, he did The Story for Made in Manhattan, starring Jennifer Lopez.
2002?
Yeah. Okay, that's Made in Manhattan. Then there was nothing until 2008 with Drill Bit Taylor.
Those were probably old. I bet those were old scripts that were just banging around Hollywood
for nothing, right? And they were all stories, so I guess he like had to fix the stories up. And then his last piece of work,
yeah,
is Home Sweet Home Alone.
That's probably, is that really, or is that just a story by credit?
It says it's it just
because
says,
he created
it says story
because of the first one. That's yeah. probably just a, yeah. an exclusive credit because he died in 2015, 16. He's been dead for a minute.
2009, he passed away.
2009. Okay, so he was definitely not around for Home Sweet Home
Alone. So I think where it caps off for him is probably around 97 with Flubber and Home Alone 3.
Right.
But at that point,
he wrote Flubber?
It says,
or did he direct Flubber?
It says that he wrote Flubber and he was a producer on Flubber.
What an interesting turn he had.
Such a weird career.
But what's your history with Uncle Buck?
Oh my God, it is probably the first John Candy movie that I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And I remember my grandmother, God rest her soul, used to bootleg movies.
Sure.
So she had the dual VCRs.
I was there. I did it.
And we used to call them the DD comps. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what I used to affectionately call my grandmother, was DD.
Yeah.
And all these DD comps would have random things on them, like, you know, wrestling matches and movies and TV shows. And one of the DD comps had Uncle Buck.
Nice.
And for some reason, it just stuck with me and my brother. And we would just watch Uncle Buck constantly.
It's incredibly watchable. I watched it again this week, which was probably for the 100th time in my life.
Yeah, I've lost count.
And there's
at this point.
There is no fat on the bone. It just sort of goes, like, there's no scene that's like, we don't need that scene.
It all works together.
And every scene, even scenes that are, like, kind of just funny, like the clown scene, right?
But that's a lot of his movies, though.
But there's character there. Like, there's still some reason for that scene.
Right, but I think that's the thread in all of his movies, though.
What?
That, like, every scene kind of fits, and there's character within each of those scenes.
Yeah, it's character driven.
It's not just filler.
No, there's no filler, yeah.
Like, you're right. Like when the clown comes to the house,
yeah,
and he's drunk, right? And now this is where you see Buck is starting to have more of a moral fiber.
Yeah.
And he tells the guy, I think, you know, would you have a couple? And the clown goes, what are you, Mother Cabrini? You never touch this stuff?
Get in your mouth.
But before that, he goes, yeah, I was at an all-night bachelorette party. You know?
What was that guy? That's a great character actor who plays him.
And then Buck goes, get in your mouth.
Get in your mouth.
And get out of here. I'm in the field of home live entertainment. I'm a god! And then he punches him, and then, like, the nose is all, like, you know, has a fist imprint in it, and he shakes it off and tries to go at him again, and then Candy rocks him again, and then it just goes to the next scene.
Yeah. See, you know what I think that scene is about? I think that, see, this movie is in the classic 80s realm of slobs versus snobs.
Absolutely.
And I think what you get with a scene like that, and also the great scene with the assistant principal, is it's showing us that, in fact, Buck could do things that the parents wouldn't. Because if the clown came drunk like that, the mother would have just let him in. Or even if she noticed he was drunk, she would have not had the confidence that Buck had to say, no, you're not coming in.
No, I think Cindy would have did it differently. I think she would have paid him and he still would have left. But I think it would have been more from a conservative standpoint.
Yeah.
You know,
but he's not a conservative guy. Like the clown, I mean. Like, you know what I mean? Like, Buck is showing like
well, he's the opposite of his family.
Right.
Right. He doesn't really play by societal norms and rules.
Well, again, great writing. The first scene where we meet him, where he's out at a restaurant with his girlfriend, Shanice.
They're eating cheesecake.
Yeah. By the way, Shanice, played by, what's her name? She's so hot right now. Amy Madigan, she's big. She's having a real resurgence right now because she's in Weapons. She actually just won a Critics' Choice Award for her performance in Weapons. She's like the bad guy in that movie, but she's also very scary in that movie. He sort of like, in that scene, basically she's like, I got you a job at my tire place. Are you going to show up tomorrow? And he's like, he don't want to, but he's going to for her. And he encapsulates who he is because he says what his worldview is. He says, I know what I love. I love my friends. I love my freedom. I like that I can throw my sticks in the car and go golfing anytime I want. It's a beautiful piece of dialogue that tells you right in the first scene we meet him, this is who he is. And this is how he's different from, like, his brother, right? The Russells, they live in a Leave It to Beaver white picket fence suburb.
Picture perfect tree lined street neighborhood.
The
all the houses.
The parents
look
the are same. Very yuppies.
Oh yeah.
I mean, one of the things that one of the like tensions is that the parents are so career oriented, they're not really that aware of what their kids are doing.
And the scene that sets that up. But before we even get into that,
yes.
What I liked and which was unheard of at the time, especially in the late part of the 80s, right? Like you've seen it in movies like Working Girl, but it wasn't really like touched upon. Here, it was a little bit different where in Working Girl, you would have they would rise to the top.
Yeah.
But it would be in a very white collar situation.
Yeah.
Similar with what was that movie? That stars Diane Keaton when she was having a baby.
Baby Boom.
Baby Boom. Right? Like she was this executive and she rose her way in the white collar world. What I liked here, it was completely different. Shanice was this blue collar Chicago woman. I don't know if you've ever spent any time in Chicago. I've been there so many times. Yeah. I love Chicago, Illinois.
Yeah, yeah.
If I could move anywhere, it would be Chicago.
Yeah.
Because it has like this real home down like blue collar.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, the city is great. And here you have this self-sufficient woman who doesn't need
him.
She has her own business.
But she wants to get, she loves him and she wants to get married.
Right.
And she says he's like a boy. He don't
want
to grow up.
And he's like, well, I want the pitter patter of little feet. He goes, well, I could get you some sheep. I get you some sheep metal and get some mice.
Yeah.
And you hear the pitter patter. And she like looks at him like, dude, that's not funny. I want kids. And then at that point, it's like you get an understanding of once it becomes too real for Buck.
Yeah.
That's when he becomes more withdrawn. Not with her, because I think he loved her. He genuinely loved her. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he was going to be some sort of like philandering playboy.
Yeah.
You know, but I think what happened is like giving up the freedom. Once you you put a ring on it, now what happens
is freedom is this, yeah.
You lose this identity that makes you you and this ability to just haphazardly do whatever you want with no consequence.
Right. And spending time with the kids changes the way he thinks about it. It's the perfect movie, and it's such a feel-good movie, too. Like, by the end of it, you feel great. And it's
because
every character, but every character, with every interaction, they all, like, Tia's better, the parents are better, the little kids, like, everybody comes away.
Well, the little kids were always the same.
They're the Greek chorus of the movie.
Yeah, I just think their precociousness brought out a side of Bucky. It was like, you know what, this ain't bad. Oh, yeah. Shit. Maybe I fucked up. Maybe I really like this. Like at the end when he goes, you know, when Shanice asks him, what happened to you? It's like a recessive gene. It skips every generation. And then he looks at her and goes, man, we should have did this sooner. And she looks at him like, you son of a bitch. And then they run off and the kids come in and they like, you know, have that slumber party. But to go back to what we talked about before with where the Russells are so career driven.
Yeah.
The scene,
like you don't even know. Maybe you're about to say it. Never mind.
The scene where they're sharing the dinner table.
Yeah. Oh, how ugly is that wallpaper?
It's the 80s,
but it shows how white they are.
They're very white.
I mean, look blue at what they with look. Like birds on it. I hate wallpaper.
Look at the. I can't stand it either. I have no use for it. If anything,
it's disgusting.
Like, if I try to, I'll peel it off your house.
It's disgusting.
I walk into anybody's house if I see a piece of wallpaper. I'm starting to peel it off. Fuck you. Yeah. But no, you see even the way she's dressed, right? Yeah. Earth tones.
Yeah.
You know, with some moderately placed jewelry.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're sitting down and they're eating the Chinese food. And Tia says, this is such a wonderful meal, mother. Where do you find the time? And it's like, you know, and the mother tries to ignore her and says, we've had enough of your ugliness. Oh, really? Yes, we're all just tired of the act. Now, it sets up where, like, she's this rebellious in pain.
Yeah.
Because they said that their life got uprooted. They were in Indianapolis, and then they moved to Chicago.
Yeah.
And, you know, and because of their careers. And, you know, the scene cuts away to the dad when they're eating. And he's like, oh, well, Miles, we got you a hockey stick for your birthday. And he goes, he hasn't – hockey's
over.
Hockey's over.
Been over for months.
And And they like, ah, so no, you're not in tune to your kids' lives. They're not,
right.
And I think the scene that really makes them grow into with Buck is that he listened to the kids.
Yeah.
And he
talks to the kids like people.
Exactly.
Which is funny because immediately Tia, the teenage one, and we don't have to go through the whole movie because I imagine you've seen it, unless you're Jen. Jen has a horrible fear of clowns. And at some point as a child, she saw the clown scene and it scarred her. And
it's like 3 seconds.
She assumes that this is like the scariest movie in the world.
It's 3 seconds. It's 3 seconds.
And I'm like, Uncle Buck wins. He beats the clown.
He beats the clown.
Still. But anyway, we don't have to go through the plot. But
should we read the plot though? Should we read the plot?
They know the plot. What I was thinking was, isn't it interesting because like Tia immediately is like, fuck, who's this guy? Fuck this guy. I don't need someone watching me. He's going to treat me like a child. But actually, if you look at the way Buck relates to the other kids, he talks to them like people. So in fact, if she hadn't been so thorny right out of the gate, he probably would have been real with her.
See, I looked at it a little differently.
Tell me.
I think she looked at it like, my uncle's a fuck up. There's a reason why my mother and father don't associate with him.
Well, that scene at the end where they're fighting, her Buck and Tia, that's hard. That's rough when she's like, they don't care about you. When's the last time they invited you out here?
Well, who are you?
And then he goes,
my parents?
Get used on your parents.
Yeah, get used on your parents.
They both get a little cutting with each other.
Hey, Buck. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sucks when somebody fucks with your life.
Yeah.
And then he knew.
He told Shanice that he was cheating on her with
Marcy, the neighbor down the street, played by the great Laurie Metcalf.
Incredible turn by Metcalf. But you know, it's funny. I was watching it this week, and there's just so much nuance in it. When Shanice calls and Tia answers the phone and says, "Oh, he's out with Marcy, the neighbor woman." She puts the phone down and smiles, but then she stops like she feels guilty. She's like, maybe that was
because she wasn't overall a bad kid. I just think she was so attention starved for her parents that, you know, she was taking it out on another family member, which is supposed to be the adult in this whole situation.
And I think and you see this in the first scene with the kids. She felt like she almost was like the parent to the kids because the parents were so busy with their careers. So I think having Buck come in to be the person who like takes care of them, she's like, why do we need him?
When our parental figures aren't here, I'm in charge.
Yeah.
And then Macaulay Culkin goes, I'm sick of you saying that.
Oh, the amount of like classic lines in this, which is like, your bag doesn't belong on the floor. Oh, let's have a cow. And then she starts pulling those, your nails are digging into my arms. Oh, God damn it.
Macaulay but again, Culkin, it shows the dynamic where she is the older sister and there's a considerable age gap between Miles, Maisie, and Tia.
And Buck knows Tia. So like, he doesn't really know the two younger ones, or doesn't even know their names.
No, he thought it was like Larry and...
That's me when I go to... that's me. I don't remember people's kids' names.
But even the scene when he...
What does he say?
Like, when Bob calls Buck, right?
Yeah.
And he's like... They hang up and he agrees to come.
Yeah.
And stay at the house. And he looks at the wife and goes, he was in bed. He was sleeping. That's a good sign.
You could tell that the mom is really the one who's anti-Buck.
Cindy was definitely anti-Buck.
The brother's not. Oh. When he calls him, he's like, hey, Bobby. What are you, drunk? Buck lives across the street from Wrigley Field. And he does the clapper.
And everything turns off.
I got to talk about this because this is a real...
Is this how you normally do PCMC movies when you break down movies?
No, usually we go through it literally go through it.
I wonder if everybody's keeping up with us because we are jumping around, but I think we're making great points.
Yeah, I don't, you know, the science of sometimes when I feel like it's a movie that people
know,
might not know, I want to go through it like point by point.
Well, I also think ours is more, instead of the movie, it's a character analysis of...
We're just remembering a movie that we've all seen.
Right. But I like the way we're doing it right now because it's not about the plot. It's about the person.
Yes.
And it's about how the people change.
Yes. What I want to talk about is the again, I want to say the word bespoke. The amazing style.
Did you just learn this word?
No, but it is a word I've been using a lot lately. There's amazing style with John Hughes. He does crazy, I want to say absurdist. He does absurdist things with editing and sound. Let me give you some examples. Buck wakes up. He claps the clapper. 80s was full of clapper jokes. And all the lights of Wrigley Field come on. What does that mean? When Maisie is in the room and she says, my uncle's been putting my clothes in the microwave. And the teacher's like, why? And he's like, she's like, oh, because he can't get the goddamn washing machine to work. And then the teacher picks up a ruler, goes, blasphemer, and it echoes. What a weird little thing. And it's also, that's in the middle of the other scene with Buck and the principal. Or how about when they learn the grandfather had a heart attack, you see a montage of everyone in the house sleeping and you hear boom, 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 boom. And then the phone rings as the final thing. And then that's the call from the dad.
Wow.
He's got all of these weird little John Hughes-isms. Even like when Buck...
Is that the difference between diegesis?
Say it again.
Like diegesis, right? Is that what it's
diegetic
called?
Diegetic sound, yeah. Is sound that is within the world of the movie.
Yeah.
So the heartbeat would be non-diegetic, right? And then the sound of the phone is diegetic, breaking through. Or how about this? Sometimes Bucks, when his car backfires, it's
James Brown.
Wow! In the beginning of, yes.
Yeah, I feel good.
That's great. That's
I wonder
that's
how much
wild.
They paid for that.
I don't know,
because that I bet you that ain't cheap.
But they're small enough that I think a person could not notice it. But I've seen this movie so many times. I'm like, why is the dog in the washing machine?
Oh, Parsi. Yeah.
Or what about the scene where that? I mean, it's plays like a silent comedy. Miles is at school, played by Macaulay Culkin, and he Uncle Buck doesn't know what to give the kid, so he's got his brown bag and he takes out all the a sausage and all sorts of crazy shit.
Sardines.
Yeah. And then he says to
eggs.
The other kid at the table, could we talk about a possible
trade?
And then a bird's eye view shot, all the other kids pull out from the table. So there's dynamic mise en scène,
yeah.
Right? Things are moving. And then you hear them all scream, which is another weird sound thing.
What about the one when he is going to the scene where he goes to the school because he has to sit with the principal because...
Yeah.
Cindy scheduled this meeting about Maisie.
Yeah.
And now you hear Tone Loc's wild thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows where, every time there was, a break or a downbeat,
yeah.
There was something that went against him. When he's smoking, literally,
yeah.
Openly smoking the cigar and then blows the cigar smoke,
yeah.
And then realizes where he's at.
Right, oh, I shouldn't be doing this.
Then puts it out, knows he has to go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
And now you see, he's this big, burly man.
Yeah.
And these bathrooms are for elementary school kids.
Yeah.
And then he, and you hear the breakdown, the
Yeah.
And now he's, looking underneath the stall to make sure, he can go to the bathroom because he's, And then he actually, he has to bend down to, pee. And he's, on one knee.
Yeah.
And, you hear the song.
Yeah,
because it's so different from.
And it's interesting because music. He also uses music a lot to represent characters.
Yeah,
in that moment, you've got that beat. But for the most part, Buck is signified by a jazzy kind of beat.
Yes,
when he's bringing the kids to school the first time, the car backfires and all the kids fucking drop down there's a gunshot, and there's a really quick shot of kids' hats blowing off and someone having soot on his face. It's Looney Tunes. There's also Looney Tunes, when he falls on his head, you hear Tweety Bird. He does all sorts of crazy cartoony shit.
And that
there's a lot of silent scenes like that. What about with the
The reaction,
the trainer,
and it breaks, and you go, oh, it's unbreakable. But what about but if we're talking about that, what about when he's at the now they leave.
Yeah.
Cindy and Bob. And he's looking around the house and he's wearing the Chicago Cubs jersey in the thermal. And he's looking at the
classic his outfits in this movie are classic.
But then he plays the piano. Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah.
And it's like, ooh, that's...
Right, because what am I doing in suburbia? What am I doing here?
I'm a fish out of water here.
Yeah, yeah.
Or even when he goes and parks the car and knocks on the next door, the across the street neighbor's, Buck? Bob?
But the editing in that scene...
This isn't funny.
...is so disorienting. And then again, the sound, all the dogs
start barking. And then Mr. Hatfield goes, for Christ's sake, it's 3 a.m.
Sorry. Buck, Bob. Buck, Bob.
I'm freezing my ass off out here. Bobby.
It's not funny, Bob. I want to go through the scene in the school, that's like silent scene in the school with the cigar. That's similar, the way that he plays with editing and music, it's very similar to the scene in Ferris Bueller when the principal goes on to the bus at the end, and it's that slow him going onto the bus, and you hear boom, chica, boom, boom.
Yeah, like it sets the tone for something.
But it's like this slow move. Like he was so good with sound and music and stuff. And even the needle drops are great.
Did he edit the films himself, or did he have the same editor? I wonder that.
I don't know. I mean, every director kind of has a huge influence over the editing, whether they're the credited editor or not.
Yeah.
But I have a feeling that a lot of these things are written in. So again, like I think it's he kind of, it's all like one expression, if that makes sense. You wanted to talk about, actually, before we talk about Bug, I want to say something more about Tia. Tia, I think it's played by Janine Louisa Kelly, and it's a great performance. And I looked her up. She's a working actress. She's still out there. She's still doing it.
Yeah, good, she was on that Mike O'Malley sitcom.
Right, but she should have been a huge star, I think. And I'm not saying anything bad about her because she's a working person, you know, but she's so fucking good at
this. She did carry large chunks of that. And to hang with...
Yes, exactly.
With John Candy is no easy feat.
Yeah, yeah.
At that point, his career was just seismic.
This is him at the top of his game. Absolutely.
It's his best film.
It's absolutely his best film. It's because it's got everything that you want from him. You've got a little bit of like him falling down, fat guy fall down. You've got a little bit of him being a bad guy. But you've got like that heart... I mean, the scene where he is, you know, he's got to make his money for the year. So he's got to go and he's got to fix a horse race.
The setup for that is incredible. When they're playing, when they're bowling.
Oh, that whole, yeah.
And they have the music's playing. It's like that 1950s, 60s music.
Yeah. Pal.
And like, but what they're doing is he's showing them how to bowl because I guess they've never went before. Yeah. And he says to Maisie, if the rules of the game was to just barely touch the pin,
you'd get as close as possible without knocking them over, you'd be champion. And then she goes, really? He goes, yes. I believe so. And then he sees Pal and you see his full face
Pal
change.
Pal is sitting and trying to hit on Tia.
But wait, this is something people have been talking about a lot, and I think it's true. Either there was an early version of the script that was darker, or Hughes was like, you know what, let the audience imagine. Buck, obviously we know that he fixes horse races, which is organized crime.
He hangs out with some shifty people.
But I think he's also an enforcer because Pal has a black eye.
Yeah, and he's got a cut on his lip,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, and when Pal sees Buck, he shits himself.
Yeah.
So Buck probably gave him that black eye.
You got a game somewhere, Pal?
You're not going to win anything points over here.
And he's like doing the...
Yeah.
The
why give him the black eye if not to try to say that?
Yeah,
I think.
I just thought it just showed like...
Not that he's a bad guy.
Who is this creepy man talking to this underage girl?
Yeah.
And he's doing these tricks with the toothpick.
Yeah.
And even that is comedy because the toothpick gets stuck in his mouth and he has to like... You see him like he has to flinch it. And then he tries to get back to being smooth.
And what does he say? He's like, oh, you like...
Broncos?
You like, yeah, yeah. All his lines are so bad.
But even seeing his friend Eddie.
Yeah.
When Eddie comes
up to
him...
Who's also like a sleazy dude.
When he comes up to him, he's like, Buck. And then they do the, E. Roger Cogswell. And they do that. And he's like, I've been checking car trunks for you. Where you been?
Yeah.
And then...
Right. What does that mean, dude? He's... Not that he's a bad guy, but Buck is a good fella.
And then he's like, Buck.
Because he's big. He's a scary dude.
Then
he's
goes, Buck,
giant.
Jimmy Bean called.
Come on.
He says he owes you and I a favor.
Yeah.
With this score, Buck, your year is covered.
Yeah.
That's
Come on. What are we saying here? What are we saying
some
here?
Underground shit.
But then
Shanice,
yeah,
when Tia fucks Buck because he can't go and do the race, yeah, and he's about to bring the kids to the racetrack.
Yeah, that's what we're getting to, yeah.
Shanice goes, oh, what? You can't bring the kids to an illegal horse race? Oh, you're getting some morals out in the burbs.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, wait a minute. So Shanice knew.
She knows what's up.
What he was doing.
But then when he puts the kids in the car, and you can see he's upset about Tia because he's like, he don't know where she is. And then Maisie, played by Gabby Hoffman, is a little baby, is like, oh, she it must have been a slumber party because she brought her a bag. And he's like, oh, you want to stay out all night? And then he gets in the car and he looks in the back. He looks in the rearview mirror and he sees the sweet little kids. And he's like, I can't take these kids to a crime.
I don't even think it's about the crime. I think to me, how I interpreted that scene, he had no problems taking these kids to the race because for them it would have been an adventure. They would have seen the horses, whatever.
Yeah.
I think for him, he looks at their faces and he sees the innocence and he realizes that this kid, this troubled 15-year-old, is still very innocent. And he feels that if he lets her go off and do whatever she's going to do with Bug, her innocence now is officially gone. I think that's why he starts to cry.
I think both things are true. I think both things, because I do think, like, yes, they could be like, oh, it's a horse race. But first of all, they would tell their parents, we saw a horse race, and they would immediately know what was up. And I think I don't think he necessarily feels bad about who he is, but I think he feels bad about, like, he shouldn't bring these kids. Like, he doesn't want to bring these little kids to what he's about to do. And he's so conflicted. But you're right, he does. He still doesn't go, though. He stays, but he doesn't. He takes the kids out of the car, but he doesn't go to it. He forgets the score, and he goes to try to find her.
Well, at that point, that's when the redemption comes now.
Right. Yeah, right? Yeah.
Because maybe up until a certain point, yeah, it was to keep up the appearances to try to get in the good graces of his brother and sister-in-law. You know?
Oh, how heartbreaking when he's looking at their wedding album.
That's the best scene in the movie, though. So the best scene, to me, is at that point, now Shanice broke up with him, and she wants nothing to do with him, right? And Tia says it sucks when somebody fucks with your life.
Mm-hmm.
And he's sitting by the fireplace, and the fire is roaring, and he got the dog, and now he's drinking, he's drunk. And he does this is probably the most, would you say the most dramatic scene in the film where he does this like monologue where he's like, boy, you had it made, Buck. Everybody used to say it, you are one lucky son of a bitch.
That's later on. That's a different.
No, that's no.
They're both scenes where he's on the couch, but him looking through earlier on, he's looking through and he sees that.
Okay, yeah, I got it mixed up.
He's been folded
because he's smoking his cigar and he looks and he sees the
and
thing.
And he sees
that
he was folded out of it. But no, that's later on. I forget. I guess that's right after the Shanice thing.
What a great attention
to
detail.
He's with the dog.
But what a great attention to detail, right?
Uh-huh.
Where they knew, oh shit, I wanted this specific. Like you said before in the beginning, every scene makes sense. And there's these weird attention to details that they actually had to do wedding photos.
Yeah.
Where John Candy has a mustache.
Yeah.
And like they had to do wedding photos for this one particular scene that is 5 seconds in length.
Yeah, right. But he's so fucking good because he's subtle. I mean, Candy. He could be broad and subtle because like the pain in his face
it
when he sees
him.
It, it's like he's heartbroken. Like, he knows, okay, they're living their suburban life, but he don't think they hate him. But he's beginning to realize, like, the mom, at least, really doesn't want
him
around.
We knew early on she didn't like him when she was, like, the trashy people he hangs out with, the woman who sells tires, the drinking, the horse racing, the gambling.
Yeah.
Could you imagine him in this house?
Yeah.
And you know... And Bobby says, but he's reliable and he's family. And then it just goes to show that he was going to drop what he was doing to go and do this for him.
Yeah.
And then he tries to kiss her goodbye. And she like backs up.
Yeah. All that stuff is so funny.
Yeah.
When he's like, do you have a plunger? No, you probably have good plumbing. I've been eating a lot of cheese.
I'm really
bound up.
Like
a big mouse. I don't know. The 5-year plan. Oh, I quit smoking. Oh, good for you. Yeah, I quit cigarettes. I'm smoking cigars now. Yeah, then I'm going to go to pipes, then chewing your tobacco, then nicotine. I got a 5-year plan.
It was just like he lives in this weird world, and I don't know if it's a perpetual state of his own ignorance, but it's definitely a world that it's in his control, and it's what he wants to do. And there's like nobody's going to talk him out of doing it.
Yeah.
Right. And so you feel that at that scene when he looks at the wedding album and realizes that he's folded out of that picture. Do you think that's the scene in which everything now starts to change in a more organic way, where, you know, maybe at first he was trying to do it to score good points, and now, like, the Pandora's box opened up and he was like, damn, like, I actually do care for these kids.
Mm, yeah.
I care for the well-being of this teenager. I want to make sure that these little ones are protected, because, you know, at that point when he's had enough of this lifestyle, this Peter Pan syndrome lifestyle,
yeah.
You know, I think that's that's a thing that, I don't know when that term was classified, but there is definitely, Buck Russell is definitely textbook Peter Pan syndrome.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's that scene where he's on the couch in the fireplace, like we talk about, he was drunk and he was just like, you had it made, Buck.
Yeah.
You know, you had no office, no wife, no kids, no real job. You know, you were one lucky son of a bitch. And then he tells the dog, but they don't say that now, purse.
Right.
And then he smokes the cigar and he's like drunk. He's fucking drunk. And then you just feel like this, like,
you realize he's realizing, like, I'm maybe a little too old for this
directionless lifestyle.
And I think what happens with Shanice makes me feel like, oh, I'm really going to lose her. Because he does love her.
I'm going to lose the one constant that looks past all of my failures and shortcomings. Somebody that sees that I am good, that I can be responsible, and that they want to have, essentially, they want to have this family with me.
Let's talk about Bug, Tia's boy. First of all,
man's a predator and you're his prey.
The all of the cool kids in this movie dress like I don't know, like cafe hipsters. They're all like berets and long like fucking trench coats. It's a very interesting look. Bug is the boy she's like dating, and he's constantly pushing her into like sex. And Buck immediately, see, that's another streetwise thing that like he would get that the parents wouldn't. Like, Buck immediately clocks him as like, this is a bad guy. That reminds me of when he drops her off and he's like, you stand me up today. Tomorrow I'm coming back in my pajamas and I will walk you to your first class. What about when the kids, he's like, you think it's a hat? This hat makes people very angry.
I'll tell you a story about this hat. But even the scene that we're introduced to him in the beginning,
Bug,
is when after the car backfires, they make the he makes that sound, and he's like, you know, he says whatever he says about the car, and he was like, you know, on a face like that in public again, and I'll kill you.
Oh yeah, he says something like, ever hear of a tune up,
yeah. Ever hear of a ritual killing? You ever know on a face like that again and I'll kill you.
Yeah.
That's a great establishing scene. Like, oh, this guy, who is this creepy young piece of shit?
He's a villain. He is a bad
guy. He is a villain.
Yeah. Again, snobs versus slobs. I feel
Do you think he was an elitist?
He's more of a beret.
And a turtleneck, mostly in that film. Yeah,
come on.
But a lot of that style of dress is now even more popular today.
I know. Well, what about, I mean, talking about expert like cinematography and editing, the whole bait and switch where Buck goes to the party and, well, first you got the hilarious thing of them, like, them taking his hat and he's got a beer somehow. And you keep seeing a dark bedroom and a silhouette of Bug and a girl and he's pressuring her. And she's saying no, and he keeps pushing her.
Yeah.
And then Buck breaks through the door, and we see it's not her; it's some other girl.
Well, do you know the music changes three times?
Really? In that?
So the first is the party music.
Yeah.
Right. Then it cuts to the music when Bug is trying to get handsy.
Yeah.
You know, and he's not, and the girl keeps on saying no. Then it goes back to the party music.
Yeah.
Right. Then it goes into this sinister music, where you see the screw gun, right? Yeah. And then the third time it changes, it's like this triumphant,
like superhero, like when he comes through the door.
But you see in the back of him, he's backlit like with this white light, and he comes in, and then it changes again back to the inquisitive music with like the sinister, where he looks at Bug, then looks at the girl, realizes it's not Tia, then it goes back to that sinister music again.
And you can see on his face, he feels sad because he knows this will hurt
her. Hurt her.
Like, her, he probably broke her heart.
Right. And he also was like, well, you know what? Now I got to fuck with this kid.
Now I have to kidnap him.
I have to kidnap him because I also don't want him to do anything inappropriate with this girl.
He saves the fucking day.
What a savior. White knight.
He saves the day.
And then he grabs her and he sees her.
Yeah, walking down the street.
And it's that, like, that.
He's in the trunk.
Yeah.
My dad's a fucking lawyer.
He'll sue your ass off,
and
man.
And then he backs the car back up.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Okay, asshole. I'm sorry. Even his apology was disingenuous.
Yeah.
So it just really just sets up who he is. And even before that, but he's petrified of Buck the entire movie. Like, even when...
Well, he's like a 6 foot tall fucking 400 pound man. Like, he's...
I think John Candy was bigger than six.
He's huge.
He's like 6'5", I think.
He's big. He's a giant.
He's a big man.
Yeah.
And then you have like this tall, skinny Bug.
Yeah.
Who would later go on to play Johnny Storm
in the pretend fucking Fantastic Four movie.
That's canon, babe.
How is it canon?
Marvel said everything's canon.
I didn't see him in the fucking... What's the wasteland from...
Deadpool and Wolverine.
Yeah, what's the name of that place?
Give it time. I bet you'll see something in Avengers Doomsday where it's like them on TV or something.
But it sucks for him at the time because he's like, that was like a bigger rover. I'm Johnny Storm.
I'm gonna star in this.
It's like, oh no, this actually wasn't a real movie. This was a pretend movie.
Flame on.
Yeah.
But so there's that scene where Buck wants to take the kids to go get ice cream. And he sees Tia and Bug are at this party in the woods.
Yeah.
And then they're making out, and Macaulay Culkin goes, that's an odd thing to do during cold and flu season. And Buck just gives like a look. He goes, yeah, it is. And then he gets out, and he's like, Bug? Nat? Is there a little similarity here? Oh. He's like, you ever talk about burying the hatchet?
I keep one in my car. And then... Tia's like, he's all talk. And then he's like, I have it right here.
I keep it sharp enough, the little slice off the shoulder.
A little meat off the kneecap. Yeah. And then the sinister music. Well, they did the same thing later, earlier on. Because
again, why would you just have, and again, to circle back to what you said originally.
Why would he just have that?
Why would you just have that? Buck does bad things.
Yeah. Buck, he's an enforcer a little bit. I don't think he's taking a life, but he, you know, he'll strong arm you. He's broken some thumbs, let's say.
I think he's did more than just broke some thumbs. 2-bit loan shock. You're a leg breaker.
Let's talk about Macaulay Culkin.
Okay.
He is very Bart Simpson in this movie. He's nothing but like, first of all, he says, let's have a cow. And also like,
that was the time,
he's
though.
All like quips and stuff. What about the interrogation scene where they're both of them sitting there? Where do you live? The city. Do you have a house? Apartment. Own or rent? Rent. What do you do for a living? Lots of things. Where's your office? Don't have one. How come? Don't need one. Where's your wife? Don't have one. How come? Long story. Do you have kids? No, I don't. How come?
It's an even longer story.
Are you my dad's brother? What's your consecutive record for questions asked?
38.
I'm your dad's brother, all right. You have much more hair in your nose than my dad.
How nice of you to notice. I'm a kid. That's my job. And then, again.
He became a star in that scene. Macaulay Culkin.
But then you talk about the sound and like how abrupt it is. You see the school bus speed by and then it goes to the next shot.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's like, it takes away from this like really quick, rapid fire back and forth from this inquisitive, I guess. He was like, what, 6?
I think 7 when he was doing it.
The comedic chops.
Yeah. Well, what about, did you brush your teeth? Yeah, I did. Really? Because I have a friend that works down at the crime lab, and he can look at your toothbrush and tell if you really brush your teeth or you just put it under the water. But then if you listen, you hear a police siren in the background.
Yeah.
Very faint. And that's when Maisie's like, we really got to start brushing our teeth.
But even that scene too, like later on where they want to sleep with him in the room to feel safe.
Well, the whole editing of that where it begins with him going,
You don't want to sleep with me.
No, the answer is no.
No.
The book is closed. New rule. No.
No.
And you don't even know what it is yet.
I'm a big drooler. And then they use that song, Mr. Sandman, and then they cut to like...
Oh, that whole edit with like the wipes with the clock. Yep. It's just so much like all the bells and whistles. But I tell you what. So I think the scene where they're alone, right? and they're waiting for Shanice to come over, and Macaulay Culkin looks through the mailbox and he sees three faces. First of all, there's no music there, which is very scary and again very absurd because it's a complete fantasy. But also, it's that's the imagination where Home Alone's of, born.
Right.
That's where Home Alone is really? Born. Really? Think about it. That's got to be because John Hughes wrote Home Alone.
He did.
He's got to be making that scene going, this is a movie right here. Think about it.
Well, I thought Home Alone, the birth of Home Alone, he did have an idea of what happens if we forget one of our kids when we're traveling.
Well, that's what gets you there. But I think that scene is like,
I think he know,
what
he
if
knew
you have this precocious kid?
Kid, this kid.
Yeah. In a house where there are people trying to come in.
And then he's sitting at the, he's sitting on like the little step stool.
Yeah.
He's eating the cheese puffs. And then like you said, the first time he checks it, it goes down. There's nobody. The second time
also,
he checks
yeah.
it, there's those three faces.
And there's like weird shit going on in their eyes.
Yeah.
Like one,
and then
like
he gets,
glass
he
eye
gets
or
scared.
Yeah. And then it's Shanice.
It's Shanice. And she's like, I'm here to come over and watch you.
Yeah.
But then there's this real, that there's a really good scene where he's like, do you have any identification? And she like puts her keys and her gloves in her mouth. And she's like about to show the wallet. And he's like, can you take it out? And she's like, take it out. Like she got like physically, like it was just like the timing between him being the straight man in that scene.
Yeah.
And her being the wildcat.
Yeah.
And reacting in a way that I think all of us would as adults to this child, like really made it work.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So
it's, he's so good. I mean, he's like a joke machine, but he's both of the kids are very cute and precocious. Doesn't anyone in this house know they keep a promise? And they both raise their hand.
I know you guys do.
Keep a promise. I know you guys do. Let's talk about Laurie Metcalf as the neighbor Marcy.
I'm Marcy.
Marcy Dahlgren Frost. Dahlgren is my maiden name. Frost is my married name. I'm single again, but I never bothered to lose the Frost. And I get compliments on the hyphen. And the buck goes, sure you would.
Sure you would.
The whole, first of all, it's pretty, I don't know if they do this today. The whole bit, the whole misunderstanding when she comes in is she thinks Buck is raping Cindy.
Yeah.
He's like, open up. I'm going to put my load
in you.
He says, I'm going to put my load in you whether you like it
or not.
And she's like, oh my God, he's raping her.
And then you hear the banging of the...
Because
it looks like he's like thrusting.
It looks like he's fucking raping a woman.
And you hear like the sounds of the washing machine and he's banging and he's trying to get it open. And as she's looking through the crack, the dog comes up and I guess like licks her.
Yeah.
And she fucking freaks out.
Yeah.
And then like scares the dog off. And you see the scene where the dog scurries off.
Yeah.
And he opens it up like, what the fuck is going on here?
Yeah.
Who are you?
Yeah.
And that's that whole scene. And he's like, oh, it's the wa-. She has like the pepper spray out. And she's like, Cindy.
Yeah.
And then he's like, no, the washing machine. I can't get it open.
Yeah.
And then she like assumes that he's this like.
A perfect early Metcalf kooky role.
Oh, she's so good.
Even like doing a voice. And she's fantastic.
I'm Marcy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But even going into, you just see how desperate she is. So when she like
oh yeah, the whole
like
just,
later on when they start to do the dirty dance,
I'll wait for the FedEx man to come.
I'll wait. And they're using that song from Herman's Down.
Yeah,
baby.
The needle drops are great too.
So good.
It's all great.
This movie's incredible.
No, it's such a fucking good. It's just so watchable. It's so good. And using Mr. Sandman during the sleep scene.
Yeah, of course, dude.
Let's talk about I think this is the classic scene when he goes to see the assistant principal. First of all, it's cute that he's talking to the kid out in the waiting room. He's like, "Yo, I'll go first, and then I'll give you a little extra time
to collect your thoughts."
And then she's like,
She's a dreamer.
She's a silly heart. I don't think she takes her educational career seriously." And he's like, "She's six. I hear that every day, and I don't take that as an excuse. I don't want to know a kid who isn't a silly heart. I definitely don't want to know a kid who takes their academic career seriously.
Yeah.
If you so much as scowl at my niece or any other kid in the school, I'm coming for you." And then she's got the wart, and he throws the quarter at her. Classic line. Go downtown and pay a rat to gnaw that thing off your face.
Well, before that, though.
And that's, by the way, the mother... from Goodfellas.
Yes.
Hendry. Who are these people, Hendry?
But even before that.
And also Jerky Boys.
When he walks in, Buck Russell, Molly Russell's wart.
Yeah.
I'm old melanoma head.
As you can see on the door, on the assistant principal, they look at the door and it's not there.
That door?
The outer door. Oh, the outer door.
And I think that's when the principal gets so fed up when she knows, like, oh, this is where she gets it from.
Yeah. She's a silly heart.
Silly heart. But again, you're right, because again, he operates.
The mother would have been like, the mother in that, again, like the clown in that situation, the mother would have been like, oh, you're
she
right.
She would have sided with the teacher.
Oh, maybe we'll get her a tutor.
Yeah.
Where Buck is like, no, like you, what is he? He says something. He's like, they're all good kids until Skaggs like you pull them down and teach them and try to convince them they're not good kids.
Yeah, no.
And then the kid outside is loving
like listening
it.
To this.
Yeah.
And what you see is, again, like you said before, he operates in a world that isn't theirs.
Yeah. I don't even have a job.
So he's at liberty to say certain things that, again, that, you know, most responsible adults wouldn't say.
Right. But it's the thing that should be said at that moment.
Right.
He wins the moment. We haven't talked about it. For a kid, when I was a kid and I first saw this, the impressive moment to me, the moment that impressed itself upon me the most, is the birthday scene with the giant pancake.
Oh, I mean, pancakes shouldn't be that big.
I still want that giant pancake.
You should have seen the toast. I couldn't fit it through the door.
I hope you're hungry. Well, what about when he's first cooking? He's like, he's cooking our garbage.
That's the best. My brother quotes that scene to this day.
He put onions in the eggs.
And then she's like, wow, I can't believe you're drinking coffee. I'm not doing it to impress you. Like, it sets the tone off rip.
Yeah.
Like, that she does not like him.
Yeah. No, yeah. What else? I want to make sure we every nook and cranny of this great
movie. I think we've covered every nook so far.
Your car's on fire.
And it's like, no, it's not, but thank you. And then he talks about
the party. Our son's there. Oh, my niece is there.
And then that's when he goes to that party.
And he fucking saves the day.
He's like a fucking Power Ranger.
It's so good. And then when Tia likes him at the end and they're happy, like, it just, it comes together. It's so good.
Well, because he even
and
admits.
And he says, like, you know, if you're ever in Chicago, we could get a cup of coffee.
But before
and he
that,
says, thank you for giving me a chance to get to know you again.
Exactly.
Because he did know her because she was older.
Right. But he was like, you know, in a roundabout way, he was saying, you know, I'm the fuck up in the family.
Yeah.
And I need your help.
Right. With Shanice. Yeah. It's, God, it's so fucking good. Can you even imagine with a different actor?
Could never.
It would not get
like
there.
Who was some of the most popular actors at that time?
Like
Bill Murray couldn't do that film.
No, because he doesn't have the light. You need the charm.
Harrison Ford couldn't do that film.
No, because he's got to be a lovable teddy bear on top of being someone who could be menacing,
who could be scary.
Right. Well, he wrote it for him. They had already made Plane, Trains, and Automobiles.
Yeah.
And they were close. Him and John Hughes were like close buddies. And he wrote it for him.
Well, I think that's also too, right? Like, when you know somebody very well. And I think that's why he executed this script in 2 weeks. It was because when you already have the character fleshed out in your head, like, this is who John Candy's going to portray. I can write it for him and have the dialogue and the setup and move certain scenes in a way that I know John could do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they had already done, I think, two movies.
Well, no, he wrote, you got to remember, he wrote National Lampoon Vacation. John Candy was in that.
Yes.
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
He directed that.
But I think he wrote
Planes,
Trains, and
Automobiles. And then The Great Outdoors, I think, was before this.
Yes.
They did 8 movies together.
So I think he has the dialogue in his head.
And then he's got, this is after, but after he has that cameo in Home Alone, which is very memorable.
He only got scale for that, too.
Yeah.
It was like $300.
Yeah, at that time, who knows what the fuck it was.
Yeah, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles came out in 88. Uncle Buck came out in 89. No, I'm sorry. No, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles was in 87. The Great Outdoors was 88. And Uncle Buck was in 89.
What a fucking...
That's
bang,
a fucking
bang,
run.
Yeah.
Boom, boom, boom.
Generational run. Well, look, let me... I don't like to tip the hat always, but I want to tip the hat, which is... We're going to wrap this baby up, but next week we're talking about the documentary about John Candy.
Oh, that's right. I'm back for another one.
You fucking motherfucks. It's called John Candy, I Like Myself. I Like Me.
I Like Me.
I Like Me, which is based on a line from Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. So we'll talk more about the big man. Thank you so much for being here, Mr. Emilio Sparks.
Michael, it's my pleasure.
Do you have any plugs you want to give?
You could just... Me. just follow me on social media, at Emilio Sparks.
At Emilio. Just everywhere, at Emilio Sparks?
Everywhere.
Are you on the blue sky?
I am on the blue
sky. Truth Social.
No, I'm not.
He's not on Truth Social, guys.
I'm not.
Well, you just turned off most of our audience.
Yeah, right? Click, bye. No, I'm not on that, but I am on everything. I'm also on Threads.
Okay, you're on Threads.
I'm a big Threads guy, actually.
Are you a big Threads guy?
Yeah, for some reason I enjoy it, and it gets really good hits for some reason. Like the nonsense tweets that I don't tweet on Twitter, I put on Threads, and it works.
I don't know. What's Twitter?
X.
Okay, X.
You remember Twitter? You used to have Twitter.
I had Twitter for like a day. No, more like a month.
Yeah.
I never got into it. And I never got into reading other people's.
Oh, I'm still all over it.
Good for you. But I hear it's a real cesspool since What's-His-Tits took it over.
Yeah, it's bad. And then you also, I guess they're bots. So I know when I lose like a substantial amount of followers, I know that they're bots.
Wow.
Because it goes down. So it's like, and then it goes up again, and then it goes down. I'm just like, this app sucks.
Bullshit.
This is a bullshit app. But follow me on all those things. I also got a cool little YouTube channel. Cooking up some fun stuff this coming year. So,
nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
We end every episode by saying,
go bye-bye.